Hello and welcome to Additive Insight, the original additive manufacturing podcast and your source for news, interviews and comments on the latest 3D printing and additive manufacturing intelligence, brought to you by TCT Magazine. I'm your host, Sam Davis, and today I'm bringing you the latest instalment of our Innovators on Innovators series. This time, Flow3D Senior CFD Engineer Alice Jackman sits down with Hexagon's Director of Business Enablement, Jeff Robertson. Throughout their conversation, the pair discuss computational fluid dynamics in additive, why industry has struggled to adopt simulation and computational tools, and the economic challenges for AM. They also ponder whether investment into AM will continue based on current market performance, and discuss a billion-dollar opportunity for the industry. If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. For more additive insight, head on over to tctmagazine.com, where you can subscribe to the print edition of TCT Magazine and our weekly Additive Insight newsletter for free.
Well, some kind of background between the two of us, which is really comes down to Lyft, I think, and our joint ventures and being involved with these kind of multi-faceted industry, academia, DoD, bringing manufacturing to the forefront, and kind of this whole digital thread happening in parallel to that, those efforts. Would you say that's where we kind of made an introduction?
Yeah, I'd say that was definitely one of the times that we were first introduced formally and had collaborations formally, was within the Lyft projects around ICME tool chains. But, you know, I've been aware of Flow3D for a long time. And also there's been connections that have been made through common customers who've wanted to span the manufacturing process simulation across different domains. The fact that we, you know, cover similar space, but a different domain or a different simulation approach, right?
Right. And to just give a little context to where we both come from and our background. So I work at Flow3D. So we are sort of a very niche CFD, so computational fluid dynamics, which, as you could reckon from that statement, is kind of exclusively focused on fluid flow. So in that context, we have taken on some manufacturing processes such as metal casting and additive manufacturing and laser welding, which sort of cross-pollinate in that they have the commonality of metal manufacturing and fluid flow. So that's where my background is, working with Flow3D and kind of leading efforts on the AM division of that, without going into extreme detail.
And I'll say to dovetail on that, my background and experience as part of Hexagon, and specifically around the SimuFact metal manufacturing simulation products, we're doing manufacturing process simulation finite element analysis. And so by definition, it's finite, right? So it's based on, you know, you have to determine and describe the, you know, the, let's just say the filler material geometry, for example, before the simulation. So oftentimes people are coming and asking, well, how do I model the, you know, how do I model the filler? How do I model the penetration? How do I model the mixing behavior that takes place in a laser weld? And we say, well, you know, there's a solution for that. It's Flow3D. And so that's actually where we first got our start of connecting, was around common customers and asking, how do we use tools adjacent to each other? How do they complement each other? And in the case of additive manufacturing, very similarly, people want to be able to do the prediction of the penetration profile or the laser powder interaction. And that's not really super effective at the macro scale, which is where we live, you know, our domain, but it is really helpful at that micro scale. And so it's really just about crossing over the domains and having these complementary tools to work together, right?
And something that is really nicely addressed at the finite element side of things and the macro scale is the thermal stress evolution. So those things are well tied together, and that the fluid flow will give you an idea about the geometry upon solidification. But then the next kind of piece of that puzzle is, how does this geometry affect stress in the material? So that's where we definitely, you know, bridge that divide, is how do you get the initial bead geometry,
right,
and how do you, you know, see those temperature gradients and whatnot, driven by fluid flow, and then, you know, take that to the next level, look at your stress, look at your distortion, which is a finite element problem.
I think one of the really easy places to visualize this is on DED, because it's really kind of a crossover between whether it's laser blown powder, laser wire, or you know, wire arc. It's easy to visualize. It's easy to see because it's maybe a little bit bigger in scale than a powder bed fusion problem in most cases, that you can see, all right, if I change the scan speed or the flow rate of powder flying in, or the spot size, or any other parameter for that matter, you're going to have an impact on that bead formation, on the penetration profile, and how much of the substrate is being remelted. And then that thermal evolution that takes place, or I don't know, how does it evolve as you go around a corner, right? You get that little hump, right, when you go around a corner, or you get the trailing off when you get to the edge of a part. Well, we don't model that effectively. You know, we don't, in finite element, you can't really, you know, you can't predict that. You have to know that going in most cases. And so this is another case where it's really easy to leverage the complementary tools to be able to have a better insight and a better model that captures the full phenomenon.
And this is really one of the driving kind of factors behind this like ICME concepts, is it's taking these individual tools that have very specific strengths and niches, and then drawing them together to get some, you know, more end-to-end engineering kind of solutions out of it, which is, you know, naturally where we came together under the LIFT initiative. But in other cases too, like our joint customers are working on this more locally. It's kind of a common theme amongst the industry, not just for additive, but also for welding, which has obviously been around a lot longer as a technology, and also metal casting. So that's definitely an interesting kind of collaboration when you have sort of adjacent competition, in the sense that we're not directly competing because we don't have the same solution, but we definitely address similar markets and similar higher arching problems when it comes to really, you know, productivity, throughput, part qualification. How do you take a new material from TRL 1 to 7? You know, what does that even mean if you look at it from experiment versus simulation? That's where we kind of address common features of our customer problems.
Absolutely. And I think that that's really, when we look at the, you know, when we talk about ICME, right, what does that really mean, you know, in the context of the, you know, additive problem that everybody's working on? I guess it depends on who you ask. But at the end of the day, what do people want? They want to know that if I build the part in this particular way, with this particular supports and parameters, with this material, that it's going to perform as intended, right? And whether that performance being, you know, the yield under load, or ultimately, I think the lifing, the fatigue life, high and low cycle is really a big one. And it's driven by so many of these very complex factors, you know, the microstructural evolution, the formation of potential defects, anomalies, surface roughness, and all these other factors. And it's like, okay, how do I get to the point where I can have confidence that, like I said, if I build it in this way, that I'm going to get a suitable outcome? And we're still quite a ways away from being able to do that, but it's through the connection of these tools. It's through the connection of these different pieces of data, along with most likely things like in situ monitoring and other sensor fusion, that we're going to get there.
Yeah, I mean, there's the ICME, which I think is a bigger umbrella over the kind of PSP piece of process, structure, right. property, performance, right? And that's sort of like embedded in ICME, where ICME is like a much broader engineering kind of linkage, you know, beyond simulation, like you just mentioned. You bring in, I mean, there, computation is in the name, obviously, so there's that component to it, but bringing in the ex situ and the in situ, creating mm-hmm. that sort of triangle, what do they call that?
Mm-hmm.
That trifecta of the three components that can really drive a holistic kind of analysis. And then you can even pull in the like machine learning AI, which of course is still in its early phase, but it's getting a lot of interest right now, because these models, I mean, that's another complexity of, and why maybe the industry hasn't been able to fully adopt computation as a replacement or as a kind of standard in standardization of materials, is that there's limitations in terms of physics, mm-hmm. but there's also limitations in terms of computational runtime. So there are some barriers.
Well, why would you, let's dig on that one a little bit deeper. Why would you say that, because this is, you know, a favorite topic, right? Why would you say that that industry has still struggled to adopt simulation or numerical and computational tools for these complex problems, right? So, I mean, you know, simulation's been around, 60 plus years, and, you know, it's pretty well accepted for a lot of things, structural analysis being primary, but many others as well, like casting, for example, pretty well accepted. But, you know, when we look at the process simulation of something like additive at that level, right, to get to a virtual certification for a part, we're still a long ways off. What are some of the things that you think are holding it back? And how does, like, for example, computational runtime fit into that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a very, very fair question. I think there's a few different reasons. So one being that additive itself isn't new, but the applications it's being used for are relatively new-ish, right? Maybe last decade or so, there's a lot more integration into like defense or aerospace or, mm-hmm. you know, things like that. So there's sort of just like the technology is new and it takes some time for people to kind of get on board with another component to it, which is simulation. And
right.
we see this a lot in all of our tools that it's, I mean, sometimes you just kind of have to show the value and it takes time for the industry to sort of get comfortable with the thought of the virtual. But then there's also the side of the complexity of the process itself. So trusting the simulation and really, so, you know, there's this with additive, you're laying down these multi-layers, you have, you know, remelting happening. There's it's multi-physics by nature. I mean, the whole process is very challenging from a physics standpoint. So, you know, the trust becomes even more of kind of a hurdle to get someone to get on board.
So one of the things I've heard in the past is that, you know, when we're comparing against a legacy process, and if you think of, you know, number one, you have a rolling of a billet, you know, that then is machined, right? Mm-hmm. And CNC machined, right? So we have pretty good confidence that if we roll it in such a way, we're going to get good consistency of the titanium, whatever the alloy is. And then if we machine it, we know pretty predictably how it's going to behave. Similarly with forging, right? It's been around for a long time. Casting, been around for a couple thousand years, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and people know how to handle this. We've been using the allowables that have been defined for castings. You know, I remember I was in a workshop where the American Makes workshops, and they were saying, you know, if people would cut open a casting, you know, that they've been certified and been flying for however long, they would be blown away by what they would find inside. You know, it's probably quite a bit of porosity, but but it was fine because it was accounted for. It was in the allowables. It was designed for that. Mm-hmm. Whereas in additive, we're making this, we have this really high bar, right? And some, you know, that we're trying to get it to a level of like, is it like, it has to perform on a par with a forging or a billet. And it's like, then I've asked the question, well, what happens if we were to just compare it to a casting instead of a forging? You know, maybe the bar would be a lot lower and we would have a lot less challenges on on accepting these parts. I don't know.
But I think there's also, because there's so much more variability, and like you're saying, mm-hmm. you know, those allowables just aren't, they're not defined at this point. And I mean, right. you talk to people working with additive, it's like they set up an LPBF machine, say they move to a new warehouse, or they, you know, they want to move that machine. It's like, you have to completely recertify the whole machine, even though it's the same machine, but it moved to a different room and they,
let
it
alone was set machine up again. To machine.
Yeah. And then, I mean, that's just with one of the same. And then you go right. machine to machine, and everyone's customizing too, right? Everyone wants to drive their productivity. So they're integrating with different, you know, optics and doing different things. Everything's unique. So it's very, you know, challenging to wrap your mind around, like, what are the allowables here and how can we even predict based on all these different variables?
Yeah, and that's, I know that that's a big effort right now, is the machine to machine variation, as well as you know, from one platform to the next, right? I'm saying just machine to machine being, you know, two of the same make and model of machines.
Oh yeah,
being
sure, different. Sure.
Or in two different locations, you know, mm-hmm. you know, we talked to somebody, you know, these major industrial companies or like the DOD, they say, well, I want to be able to print the same part here or the same part in some forward deployed area and get the same outcome, right? Just send the file, hit go, right? And it just works. You know, how do we get to that point? And it's, there's still a lot of questions to be answered for precisely that reason, that we are literally building the part, you know, little weld by weld mm-hmm. as we go. And so there's so much room for variability.
And there's also the challenge that with so many of these parts, there's so much less testing that can even happen, because say you're building a rocket. I mean, it's massive, or, you know, a piece of an engine or something that is, you know, meters long. There's a lot of material. There's a lot of time. You could sit there for a month waiting for this to print. So there's not a lot of testing that can go, like building a test piece and then, you know, doing a variation and building another test piece. So there's a lot of interest on the kind of like feed forward control to predict before printing for these right. very large pieces, which is difficult from a simulation standpoint to say, you know, you've printed it before, you've done the cuts, we've done the validations, and now we can variate based on that, because, you know, the testing, the experimental tests are also just not there.
Well, that's not only that, I think that the experimental testing and the process to get qualification or to make a change, that's one of the things that limits the economics of additive manufacturing today this process is so expensive and time consuming that it makes it really difficult, you know, mm-hmm. for these major manufacturing companies to pull the trigger on it, right? To say, there's no economics there still, except in pretty limited cases, right? Rocketry is a great example, or, you know, satellites, or really high end, really expensive applications, you know, are some of the ones that where it fits. But, you know, we're not mass producing parts to go on a commercial airliner Mm-mm. in most cases, because it just, the economics don't make sense.
Right, right. Yeah, if the problem, you know, don't fix the what's not broken or what have you. There's so, I mean, there's all these conventional manufacturing methods are well and good for things like, you know, mass production of automotive parts and things like that. So there's not really, it's really the customization where additive becomes interesting and, you know, economically viable. But then, because everything's so custom and unique, then how do you certify it? How do you kind of have this tried and true methodology that you can say that can, you know, carry from machine to machine and part to part and material to material?
And I think that is one of the big limitations in the sources of a lack of confidence today mm-hmm. is that we don't have a clear understanding on what that looks like. It just hasn't been written down yet, right? We haven't, the powers that be who write the standards have not written the standards per se mm-hmm. to say, if you do it this way and you follow this procedure, then, you know, we'll accept it, you know? So,
right.
And I'm a little bit on the outside. I don't participate in these processes directly. So I'm speaking a little bit outside of my lane, but that's what I've heard, right. You know, and simulation, the role of simulation in these certification process is largely outside, right? There's not like, it's not a defined component, mm-hmm. you know, and for a number of reasons, I think people think the current view is, you know, the simulations don't necessarily offer enough insight. And in many cases, they're not predictive enough, right? Like they can't give me enough, we can't trust it to a point where it's going to be. No, and that's something that I think we have to overcome with time and, right. and just proving it out, right?
Right. And that's where I think it's not even always that it's not predictive enough. It's just that the predictions haven't been demonstrated.
Accepted, you know? And yeah, demonstrated.
Right. And especially when it comes to like, you know, the hierarchy of a business. So maybe the engineer on the floor is convinced, but then convincing up through the chain, I mean, that's a different story as well.
Yeah. Well, and some other things, you know, we hear a lot about variability, right? Whether it's machine to machine variability or process variability within the machine. How do we capture that? And that's another limitation of simulation. At the end of the day, a simulation is just a math problem, right? And it should always, the answer should always be the same. Now, sometimes there's a little variation, but but how do we capture variability? You know, if 2 + 2 is always 4, how do we get that, you know, plus or minus? And right, so that's right. something where that's typically been handled through like a DOE study in the past. That's nothing new, mm-hmm. right? But how do we incorporate that? How do we build that in? And because mm-hmm. you have to know what you're varying ahead of time and have some way to prescribe that going in to the simulation to be able to evaluate the variability and the influence of the multiple variables together and to right. create that response surface.
And even also to kind of account for variations that aren't addressed in the simulation, like, you know, the differences in machines, like you said.
Yeah.
It's those things are just they still need to be accounted for in your process development in your DOE, but you aren't addressing them, you aren't capturing them in the simulation. So how do you sort of put that into the design space? And that's where some, you know, there is still like the kind of triangle of the in situ, the ex situ. There's still some necessity, of course. You can't entirely replace mm-hmm. this kind of DOE or this certification with a completely simulation driven approach, but yeah. there's certainly areas where you can save a significant amount of time and money by offloading certain analysis to a simulation, such as, you know, you want to vary your heat flux, you want to vary your power, your scan speed. I mean, you can blast through a ton of material trying to do that experimentally.
Yeah.
Whereas you can, you know, offload that on your simulation, that piece. And then, okay, so you got a bit of more of a honed in on your window from your simulations. And then you take in the variables of, okay, my machines vary such and such amount on, you know, different, even just like mechanical vibrations, you know, those are like real tangible things that change the result.
Or how about the scan strategy? Right. Like,
right.
You know, I mean, and those are things that should be knowable, right? That it's like, mm-hmm. okay, here's the actual scan vectors. And now there's one aspect of this that I've seen is that the machine OEMs are still a little bit, you know, part of the problem, I'll say, that mm-hmm. that they don't want to open up about how are your scan yes. vectors created? How right. do we define this? It needs to be in some degree kind of open. Mm-hmm. for us to be able to document and record what are those scan vectors literally line by line, and ensuring that if we have a model that it actually reflects the actual scan vectors. Because what point is it if I'm going to do a simulation on a scan vector level basis, but then the actual vectors of what's being built are different?
Which because has a huge impact. I mean,
it's not
inconsequential. Yeah. Well, that's too,
or machine, I mean, to machine, that, right? That's a big impact.
And that comes
there.
From this, you know, the uniqueness of additive. It's like everything's IP and everything is proprietary, and yeah. everyone, you know, has their own way of doing things. And there probably is a ton of similarities between different machine manufacturers.
Oh, yeah.
But of course, if they don't tell you how to replicate stuff, which I get, I mean, you know, it's commercialization, but there also needs to be, if there's a common interest in bringing additive to like the forefront and more adoption, then we have to have that visibility so we can standardize, so we can, you know, make things, make it more digestible.
So I interesting, I had a this conversation with some folks from the Navy that we're in a project with, and I said, why don't you, as like the DOD, or the customer, let's just say, get together and say, hey, machine manufacturers, we need you to be open or to release this or to make this accessible so that mm-hmm. we can document it and somehow incorporate it when we're creating technical data packages or TDPs to do the certification process, or to, let's say, interact with simulations so that we can have this. And the feedback was really like, we're not in a position to do that. We can't force that, you know, sure. and which I understand. And so I said, okay, well, what's keeping the machine OEMs from doing it? And I think that at this point, it's still that there's a degree of like the self-interest outweighs the, you know, interest in the community advancement or the advancement of the technology.
Sure.
And they'd right. rather keep the IP as IP rather than, you know, exposing it, you know, out of fear for competitiveness to advance the technology and the industry as a whole. And so I think that's just something we're going to have to get past eventually.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you certainly can't expect businesses to be altruistic and, you know, just trying to,
no.
for, I mean, as a collective, you might find a gem in, you know, the collection here and there who are, you know, just interested in the greater education on the matter. But I think there have to be ways to get around that, and to where, you know, there can
that's
be
where
ways
it needs to lead.
To yeah. sort of, and it almost brings us back to the ICME, because if there's linkages between tools to where IP is protected, right, and you mm-hmm. can still capture the vectorization without making it mm-hmm. just public knowledge, then that's mm-hmm. something that you could leverage, you know, in terms of, okay, you have a machine, totally understand, you want to keep your vectorization, that's, you know, a core feature of what makes your machine great and unique, but, you know, you also want to drive innovation with your machine, and so yeah. you need to allow for simulations to capture the great things that your machine is doing with the material, and how is that affecting process dynamics, how is that affecting solidification and stress buildup and all of these things. So they're, I think that's, you know, that's where the tool chains come in, and that's where
yes.
IP is protected, but the linkages can be provided.
I agree. And I think that's where it's going to need to lead. Because I wasn't proposing altruism nor expecting it, just pointing out that it was a challenge we've got to overcome. And I think you're mm-hmm. spot on that whether the tool chains that protect IP is the way that we're most likely going to get there.
Right, right. But then, I mean, that's in and of itself a very challenging thing, because you have to be some kind of middleman between a bunch of, and there's efforts to do this. So Lyft is one of them. Mm-hmm. There is a NASA call that came out. I forget the name of the group that's, but Carnegie Mellon and Johns Hopkins.
The STRI Technology Research Institute. Yeah, it was JGU and Carnegie that got funded for that. And so that's right. That's an interesting one. I'm actually trying to get involved in through my collaboration with Pratt and Whitney and with our tool, our AM defect solution that we've just released, which is, you know, doing the defect prediction at the mesoscale, at the scan vector level. And powder layer level, and being able to predict whether it's lack of fusion, porosity, keyholing, balling, surface roughness. But we see that this, obviously, something like that sort of a simulation, which is unprecedented, it doesn't have a parallel today, we see that there's obvious ties and benefits to what the mission of the STRI, of that NASA STRI is, and how we could make those connections there. And ultimately, the goal being, you know, lifing. Right. Qualifications, or rapid qualification certification, I think was the title of the original project call.
It's definitely the theme amongst, at least to my understanding.
That's the whole thing.
The theme. Right. That's the
whole
thing.
That's what everybody's chasing.
It's to drive, you know, standards and qualification, which is, you know, realistically probably a a half a decade off, but I mean, you got to put in the groundwork, and the collaborations have to be there. And that's kind of, you know, the biggest thing is the collaborations have to happen for this to work.
Right. And I think there's the desire is there amongst, whether it's the participants, the machine manufacturers, the software companies, the end customers, the government agencies, where really the funding typically comes from at this stage. There's agreement there that the potential mm-hmm. exists. People want to see metal AM and polymer, but metal AM in this context be successful. And but we recognize that we have a ways to go. I like to call the problem of qual cert just generally, I call it the $1 billion problem of AM, because if we could figure that out, it's $1 billion, potential. I'm not trying to put a number on it, but it's a big number.
Large.
if we could make AM actually get over that hump, that is the one biggest hump that prevents widespread industrialization of the technology.
Right.
Beyond what it has reached today.
And it seems in the U.S. specifically, there's a lot. I mean, there's directives, from the executive branch that this is important to drive American manufacturing to bring it home in that way, because so much of our manufacturing has mm-hmm. been, shipped out. And this is a more compartmentalized solution to manufacturing. So it's a way to, bring that back and to by driving the innovation here. Which, there's worldwide collaborators on this in a lot of cases, but a lot of it is actually U.S. initiatives to at least drive those collaborations. And the drive is certainly there. I mean, I don't think that's even the issue. It's a massive problem. It's a massive undertaking to bring this technology, full circle to mm-hmm. the point where it's easily adoptable and it's easily understood what the benefits are, how it affects part quality. How you can actually adapt it to new applications, things like this.
Yeah, I would say, though, I'm not totally convinced on the current state of the industry. If we just with respect to, let's say, the Gartner hype cycle, where do we sit, right? Are we coming out of the valley or are we heading into it? If you see the recent news and let's say stock prices of some of the 3D companies, 3D printing companies, it's maybe not super optimistic, right? That there's,
that's true.
We've had a lot of hype, a lot of marketing, a lot of things that were sold to venture capital. And then guess what? It didn't pan out that way. And now we're, somebody's got to pay the piper. But I think that we're going to probably have some consolidation and, reconciliation, if you will.
Well, you're touching on
a
very controversial take there. Just kidding. But seriously, there's
a
lot.
Right?
I mean, there's two camps of thinking on that and the whatever the trough of disillusion, right? So it's like, are we heading down? Are we headed up? And I think there's the part that's like the maturity plateau or whatever. And that is where I think we're getting to that stage where it's like, yes, there is so much hype. It was like use additive for everything. There's all these little startup companies that we saw, a lot of consolidation, a lot of kind of turnover in the past year or so. And it's become a huge talking point of, speculating on where additive is going to go. And is it, are we going down? Are we going up? What's happening here? But it seems that, that the technology, like I had mentioned before, is not new. And it's the applications that were new. And so those applications, many of which were just unrealistic in terms of cost effectiveness, but where we mm-hmm. really see the benefit is, in the DoD sectors, in the aerospace sectors. And, I mean, that's not a bad thing because those sectors are the ones that have a lot of funding and they have a lot of drive and need for,
Well, they also have a lot of supply chain issues, right? So
that's true too.
Mm-hmm. The challenges with going and getting a part that is where the tooling's gone and sustaining operations for 50-year-old airframes or engines platforms and things that, you know, where it's just impossible to get these parts, or, you know, you don't have a supplier, you know, what do I do? Or to go back and find that process for, you know, that was traditional metal forming plus welding of a tube, of a duct, you know, it's like, it's going to take, you know, 6 months to get a part. Okay, well, print me one.
And
to get to that level is a lot, you know, those are the lower hanging fruit. You know, I think it was the, was it Mark Saunders who did the, from Renishaw, who did the staircase of additive, right? And, and the part direct replacement was a really great one. It was a stepping stone before, you know, full DFAM. And of course we can't all have complete DFAM, like you might've seen on let's say the GE Catalyst engine, right? Which is fantastic, amazing what they did. Or in rocketry, right? With some, there's a whole host of companies now, small companies, big companies who are doing this and doing pretty amazing stuff. But you know, it still has to make money, still has to be accessible to reach the plateau. And maybe I said it brought up a controversial point intentionally, just to see, you know, it makes the conversation interesting. Are we still headed down or are we headed on our way up? And, you know, my question on that, where I really want to know is, you know, if we're still headed down, how far do we have to go before we hit rock bottom before, and do people continue to invest?
You know, that's some of these companies,
right. If the funding dries up and if companies start going out of business or have to go, you know, get more money to stay solvent, you know, then what, you know, your CEOs start resigning, no current events or anything, you know, and then all of a sudden there's new management that have to be brought in. You know, it doesn't make people feel warm and fuzzy about it.
Well, so, I think it's undeniable that we're in that trough somewhere. Right. And it probably is almost even industry, like additive as an industry maybe is a little too broad because the applications and the viability themselves. I mean, there's maturity in different applications that probably fall different places on that curve. So, you know, it depends on where you're working, but certainly the consumer level, like the consulting level of.
Absolutely. Non-metal, that's kind of where stuff. Oh, yeah.
Well, the consumer
stuff. That's not going to go away.
That's not going to go away. But what I mean is the consultant firms, the additive consultants, where they're kind of like, you know, bring us your design and we'll build it for you. I feel like those are the ones that are a little bit on the edge of, is this even a viable business platform or not? Because how many parts do you realistically need to print versus, you know, what's already out there?
Well, it's not super scalable. Right. In its current form to go to in mass. Right. And using the best example of scale in metals is what GE's Auburn facility running the fuel nozzle. Right. Mm-hmm. Like that's like the biggest scale that anybody's done so far. But these contract manufacturers, I'm sure it's a viable business. It's still always going to remain this small business in most cases. You've got some companies out there like the Syntavias or Morphs that are getting a little bit bigger. Right. But how big is big? Right. How far does it go? I don't know. I mean, you know, we'll see.
We'll see. We'll see. Yeah.
And I mean, then I mean, dream about the day of lights out manufacturing where there's just, you know, a whole warehouse is full of machines printing things. Right. And automated post-processing and, you know, but I think we still got a ways to go.
We'll see. We'll see. I mean, I'll just say we got a 3D printer at our house, especially, you know, we can print toys for the kids on the demand. That was kind of the idea. But I mean, they're not efficient. So most stuff,
they're really slow, pretty.
I mean, unless you want to print some real weird thing that broke on some appliance and you're like, okay, I don't want to go spend a couple $1,000s to get a new microwaves aren't that expensive, a new refrigerator. And there's this little clip, you know, that broke. That is a totally realistic purpose for like home hobby level FDM machines. But for the most part, I think it's also just kind of hype driven. I mean, it's a fun thing, you know, programming. It's almost like a STEM learning tool, but I don't know, you know, how far the practicality goes.
No, but like, but like polymer multicolor, like the HP multijet, you know, for, you know, for medical, like training device aids, like fantastic. Sure. Can't no parallel, right? Like compared to what was available in the past. And so, I mean, there are certain areas that are just without question.
Right. But, right. Right. But that's again, niche. That's like you need something very specific that you are not going to get from, you know, some injection molding, whatever shop.
Right.
So yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, that's the landscape from our, you know, outsider simulation expertise.
Well, it's interesting you say that because, you know, I've always felt a bit of an outsider, right? And so in fairness, I've been around machines. I've been around people operating machines. I've never been trained or operated a machine myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I operate in the software space.
Sure.
So we're just a part of the tool chain that people mm-hmm. use to help facilitate the overall workflow. And so we want to make sure that we're effective and we're helpful. But at the end of the day, you still got to have people who actually make the parts, and we got to help solve the problem. I think that you can't get around in additive. You can't, it's maybe the first manufacturing that is cannot be divorced from software, right? Like yes. There's no way to go back, right? And so, you know, in what way can we facilitate that? What's going to be the future state? And I think that everybody acknowledges that software is going to be key. And it's just a matter of the interconnectedness and how we can make it work in these tool chains to be efficient and effective to drive the technology forward.